Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopez, and today I'm here for a second time with Dr. Colin Holbrook. He is Assistant Professor of Cognitive and Information Sciences at the University of California, Merced. He researches decision-making under contexts of threat, with particular focus on political orientation, group prejudice, and the representation of mental states. And we will cover some of those topics today and also others. So Dr. Holbrook, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, great. So let's start talking a little bit about threat. Last time, most of the interview was focused on it, but let's try to dig a little bit more into the topic. So I think that last time I asked you at a certain point if there were different kinds of threat or if it was only one type that applied in different domains. So could you tell us more about that? I mean, when we talk about threat in psychology or social psychology more specifically, what is the phenomenon that we're talking about?
Okay, great. That's a good place to start. So the way you teed that up was with regard to how threat is dealt with in social psychology. Yeah. So I'll say a quick word about, which is going to be broad and somewhat unfair and overly general, about how it's usually discussed, just as a way of setting apart the things that I try to do in my research.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of social psychology work, if you were to go on PsycINFO or Google Scholar and put in things like threat as a keyword, you would see a huge sort of archipelago of different little sub-literatures that are looking at varieties of internal psychic anxiety. This is something that sort of has a flavor of clinical therapy or clinical roots. And in fact, some of that work even is, in terms of its intellectual forebears, goes back to people like Freud in some regards. And what's either implicit, sort of baked in, or explicit in many cases to these various theories, and these could include things like even system justification theory, certainly terror management theory, reactive approach motivation, uncertainty management, and I could keep going. There's a coalitional psychology approach that's taken some of this on. But what much of this work does is it presumes that, and sometimes with trying to touch on evolution or bring in natural selection as a potentially relevant force, but the sort of premise, which I don't know if you can tell by the way I'm trying to be fair, but I find the central premise to be a little bit hard to wrap my head around, which is that anxiety is an adaptive problem. Mm-hmm. In other words, most social psychologists who work on threat will treat the threat-related anxiety as the problem, and they will frame adaptive responses as anything that palliates or attenuates, reduces, drives away the anxiety. Yeah. So in other words, they'll look at what they call, quote, defensive reactions or compensatory reactions. And the framing is that these actions people take, now they could be sort of increased stereotyped or group prejudice kind of reactions, or they could be any number of things. It's too big to go down this rabbit hole, but they're all sort of to the end of reducing the anxiety, which is supposedly the source of the problem. So you'll get stories like anxiety is crippling, and so therefore we couldn't function and go about our daily lives and pursue food and mates and health and status or whatever, because we would be so paralyzed by our anxiety. Or some people will tell a story about how anxiety is bad for your health or things like this. Okay, so I think there's value in a lot of that work, and some of the methods are very clever, and I borrow from them pretty frequently. But I think that anxiety is an adaptive response to actual threats, mm-hmm. and that the the way to think about it isn't in terms of negating anxiety, it's about responding to threats. So what do I mean? And you asked earlier, is there just sort of one monolithic threat system or subdivisions?
Yeah.
Definitely subdivisions. Because when you start thinking about extrinsic, like threats in the world, not sources of neuroses generated by the mind from within, but external threats, we're talking about things like violent conspecifics of other humans or other animal agents that could pose a threat of violence. We're talking about, obviously, as we're recording this in the context of a global pandemic, we're talking about pathogens of various kinds. We're talking about things that will do real physical harm of various ways. And another sort of threat that's very distinct would be the threat of scarcity. So, you know, not having physical resources is another pathway. And each of these, and one can go on, lacking social resources or being isolated and not having that kind of social capital to help you should you need it. Pathogens, violent conspecifics, resource scarcity, social isolation, and you can go on and create this taxonomy. But each of these invokes or should invoke a somewhat distinct threat psychology, I believe, which will enable people to meet the challenges that are inherent to those threats. So the kind of response we want to marshal to the threat of a disease is not the same that we want to marshal to the threat of resource scarcity or a violent conspecifics. And there's many, that's, I think, a pretty intuitive and non-controversial take. Mm-hmm. But it is remarkable to me how little, I mean, and there are lots of people who work on these areas, to be sure. But within social psychology, almost all the light is shining on how do we reduce anxiety, as though anxiety were itself the problem, not the eliciting threat.
Mm-hmm. So at a certain point there, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you mentioned that anxiety is an adaptive mechanism in response to real threats, right? I think it was something like this that you said. And so, but isn't it the case that sometimes people respond to things that we could say are not real threats, that are things that are, for example, communicated socially by other people, but don't exactly correspond to something real? I mean, that would be an example. And another one, I think, and that we mentioned last time, would be the, for example, the hyperactive agency detection device, right?
Certainly. I mean, the question of whether the perceived threats in the world that marshal relevant adaptive psychologies or suites of responses that are more or less a good fit for tackling that kind of threat, that's totally to one side of the question of whether the threat is even real.
Okay.
And actually a very interesting, I don't know how much we'll go into this today, but individual differences in the degree to which people perceive threats in the world is very theoretically interesting, but also very socially and translationally important thing to understand. And my colleagues and I, especially Theo Samore, who's a doctoral student at UCLA, and Dan Fessler and Adam Sparks at UCLA, we've done a number of studies looking at political orientation as it indexes threat reactivity. And so just as an example, we found that relative to political progressives, political conservatives, and again, I think this is a sort of proxy for an underlying psychology that's probably more faithful to the human mind, because the modern political parties and things are very weird.
Yeah.
But what we found is that using this sort of proxy for some kind of underlying phenotypic difference in attitudes and orientation, which somehow maps to political orientation, we found consistent patterns of difference, and many other labs have found as well, where political conservatives are more prone to detect threats, especially threats from agents. And this manifests in many interesting ways. So automatic attention. So if you show a group of people images of, for example, predatory animals or guns or things like that pointing at them, those who are relatively progressive will be less distracted. But those who are relatively conservative will tend to automatically orient to those kinds of stimuli. And some of this work has been misrepresented in the popular science press as suggesting that this means a sort of Chicken Little viewpoint on political conservatism, something like timidity. It's not at all accurate. What it's more like, I always give the example of in Star Trek, something like Klingons. If you look at Mr. Worf on the Enterprise, he's constantly suggesting they raise shields, fire phasers, regard ambiguous alien creatures and so on as posing a threat. But he has complete confidence in the ability of his team to meet the threat and destroy it. That's just one place you could touch on, but political orientation is linked to this sort of lower threshold for categorizing ambiguous people and situations as threatening, but also higher confidence in using force or other kinds of direct interventions to meet successfully that challenge.
Yeah.
And if you think about that in terms of, and this is highly speculative, but if you think about perhaps the origins of why we would have, it's an open question the extent to which something like the political phenotypes, say, of progressive and conservative, or, and I think there's a third interesting case of the disinterested, people who don't identify either way. But to what extent this pattern obtained in the ancestral past as well, or does today in small-scale societies. I suspect that something like it does, and I think it's because there are trade-offs. So if you are in a world in which there truly are hostile conspecifics, or you know they're coming to steal your water, it pays to have a lower threshold for categorizing those groups as enemies and then meeting them aggressively for deterrent reasons and for other reasons to eliminate the threat. However, if you're in a world where there's actually opportunity for cooperation and exchange of ideas and information between groups and valuable culturally evolved pieces of data, if you instead foreclose those opportunities to learn and gain new technologies and so forth, and instead attack, then that's a cost. And so I think depending on the world you're in and given the dynamics of the world where it is the case that sometimes they really are out to get you and sometimes they're not, I suspect that there's some kind of balancing effect there. And that one reason why we seem to have this abiding distinction between progressives and conservatives is that, and there are other differences as well, but with regard to threat reactivity, you know, both strategies are adaptive or maladaptive depending on the world that the person is in or the group is in.
Let me just ask you more of a general question here, like the first one. So when we talk about threat, it is also important for us to talk not only about perhaps the emotional aspects of it, but also about the kinds of responses that it elicits in people, right? And I mean, sometimes people feel threatened and they just want to run away or avoid the threat, but there are other times where they try to eliminate the threat, right? So when do people take one approach or the other? Are there specific circumstances where when one response works better than the other, or perhaps even since you were talking about political orientation, are there, for example, any individual differences that we know about or in how people respond to threats or not?
Well, there's a lot that could be said. I'm going to try to make my answers a little shorter. But leaving aside politics for the moment, first, I just want to bring up the point once again that when we're talking about threat in the abstract, we're sort of necessarily talking about something that to some extent doesn't exist. Yeah. It's a sort of generalization or superordinate way of describing mm-hmm. these many distinct domains of threat. So just to give two examples that I think are illustrative of, you know, why there would be different reasons one might respond in different ways. Let's consider pathogen threat and the threat of violence. Mm-hmm. So I've done a little work on disgust sensitivity and related questions, but others who have done a lot more find converging evidence that mm-hmm. is not a lot surprising, which is that, for example, when kin are the potential source of contagion, people tend to invest more time and effort caring for them, inherently putting themselves at greater risk of contracting a disease, yeah. Because of, you know, the inclusive fitness benefits or other motives, perhaps related at the proximate level of the psychology to things like affiliation and love. But so that's a situation where it depends, you know, is this your romantic partner? Is this your child? Is this a parent? Is this someone, is this a friend? Under those circumstances, there are clear incentives to incur the risk of getting sick yourself in order to help that other person. That's just one example. And even with regard to a choice of sexual partners, if people find themselves in a pool in which there are very limited options, mm-hmm. things like relatedness, which would normally be abhorrent because they do raise the risk of genetic defects and things as a result of incest. But if there are no other alternatives, then cousins may be less off the table than they otherwise would be, for example. Or people who are older or might otherwise not be as invoke a sexual form of disgust. Mm-hmm. There's research, I would point to the work of Josh Tiber and Deb Lieberman, especially mm-hmm. on this kind of work, showing a sort of strategic tendency to be less disgust prone given the logic of the situation. Mm-hmm. And the incentives. So then another example would be with regard to violence. And this is something that me and my colleagues have done a little more work on. So we did work, for example, indicating that parents are highly incentivized to try to avoid danger when they can, more so even than other people, mm-hmm. because of the great risk. Even if they are injured, then that's going to be a great cost, not only to themselves, or killed, but to their offspring, but certainly the risk to offspring. And so we did a series of studies. I'll spare the details, but the sort of high level result was that in an ambiguous situation with an ambiguous threat, parents were strikingly more, they had a tendency to attribute greater threat and to show greater tendencies to withdraw from the situation. Mm-hmm. Even when their children were never mentioned in the research. And even when controlling for demographic covariates, the fact of parity, being a parent, seemed to index their greater incentive to avoid being harmed and to defend. And that effect was even stronger when their kids were around. But sometimes you can't run away. And this I would point to some really cool work by someone who I happen to be married to. Jennifer Hunt Holbrook's doctoral work was about lactation aggression in humans, mm-hmm. in which she showed that for the first time, this had been shown in some, but not all other mammalian species. The idea was that mothers, generally speaking, women are incentivized to avoid physical conflict, mm-hmm. More so than men. However, the mother of a new baby, a vulnerable infant, and this coincides with the period of breastfeeding, mm-hmm. has great incentive to try to protect her child because she's invested so much. And especially given that if you look at the archaeological record and other indicators, childhood mortality was very likely in the early months in the first year. Yeah. And so what she found was that, sure enough, breastfeeding mothers were dramatically more willing to physically aggress against attackers than non-mothers of the same age, mm-hmm. controlling for demographics, and also the bottle feeders. The reason being that natural selection appears to have co-opted the mechanism of breastfeeding as a handy way of indexing that period of greater vulnerability. And so here's another adaptive incentive where, in terms of the psychobiology of it, it seems related to lowering the mother's fear of counterattack.
And
so you can go on and on with this. But the overarching idea is that for various threats, there will be trade-offs. And when it's worth the risk, people will approach the threat, whether that be a sick relative or a potentially violent attacker, more so than others. But when the incentives go the other way, they're more inclined to keep their distance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and since we're mentioning also an aspect of our human sociality, what happens within groups? I mean, when people are exposed to threat or there's some kind of threat salience, what happens to, for example, their levels of cooperation with their in-groups, and how do they react to out-groups, particularly the ones that they think or find are the sources of threat?
Well, this, I mentioned earlier that a lot of the social psychology on looking, although it's framing this in terms of anxiety as a problem and so forth, that some of the methods may apply. But this actually intersects pretty dramatically with the replication, the replication crisis, as it's called, which is there was a very famous narrative, and one that I believed as well, which said that when people were reminded of death in particular, that they would tend to sort of circle the wagons and become more biased in favor of their group and against perceived enemies of the group or even critics of the group.
And you're mentioning terror management theory, right?
Yeah, this terror management theory, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at my published works, I'm pretty consistently pretty strong critic of terror management theory. That having been said, I would have said a year ago that some of the data were still useful. But in this regard, an open science framework project, a mini labs study, I believe 19 different labs, tried to replicate the basic effect where you remind people of death and then they become more biased in their group chauvinism, found absolutely no evidence that this effect is even real. So when you ask me the question, you know, what do people who under, you know, given certain kinds of cues, and of course I would say that having people write a few sentences in an online study or in a laboratory is a pretty pale version of real world cues. So now, right now we're in a pandemic in situations of intergroup conflict or warfare. I would almost say, like, we need to look at the history as more instructive about what people do than psychology experiments. But I think that it's complicated, is what I think. But I think that the basic story that people will necessarily become more group biased, at least based on this mini labs replication by, I think, Klein et al., that came out last year, that doesn't appear to hold up. So, but there's many other, I mean, I don't want to go down too much of a tangent, but there are certainly contexts in which cooperation is enhanced towards a shared common good, you know, to defend the group or to address the threat. And I think you kind of need to set up the question with a little more specifics, because the actual world and the way these things play out with regards to what groups and how do you define the in-group and so on, it's extremely heterogeneous.
So it would probably be influenced also by people's, for example, political orientation, or if, for example, they are religious or not?
I believe that it would. And You kind of want these interviews to be evergreen in the sense that they're not just commenting on the things that were happening at the moment. Sure. But as we're recording this in the United States, there's a pretty clear, this is not, you know, I'm trying to look at this as a scientist, but I'm also a person and I have my own political sure. lens and so forth. So completely acknowledging that, it appears to be the case that on the right, the political right in the United States, and I'm not sure how much this is true of the rest of the world, there is an impulse, maybe a strategy, to frame the cause or the responsibility for the cost of the pandemic in terms of intergroup conflict. Mm-hmm. So right now we're hearing a lot of saber rattling about China and that the United States should possibly inflict sanctions on China or other kinds of costs, and to sort of turn this into a group conflict. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, highly speculatively, but I think that might make more intuitive sense to, if it is true that political orientation is related to some somewhat evolutionarily endowed difference in detection of potential threats and then confidence in meeting them, mm-hmm. that if you can go ahead and spin the story that, okay, this group is to blame for this. Maybe they even did it on purpose, yeah. or at least their negligence is to blame. Then that could be extremely effective in terms of coordinating people who subscribe to that narrative to direct their antagonism towards that group. Mm-hmm. And perhaps along the way to shore up solidarity with their own group, which a more objective analysis might suggest could have responded competently on any level to this pandemic and saved possibly tens of thousands of lives. And so I think that the sort of comfort in some respect or the intuitiveness of framing this as, no, these are now outgroup enemies. It's their fault. Let's band together and punish them frame this as a kind of, hopefully not hot, but a kind of intergroup conflict or warfare, maybe more certain audiences that differ in their threat reactivity in that profile might be inclined to embrace that kind of a narrative, and that would change the nature of their response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so let me ask you now, because one of the big topics, and since you also mentioned terror management theory, I mean, and I've had lots of people that do work in the cognitive science of religion on the show. Let's talk a little bit about religion and the relationship between threat and threat salience and religiousness. So, to manage their threat, the impact that threat has on their psyche, there's some literature out there that says that people basically appeal to God or something like that to appease their bad feelings, let's say, when they are going through some sort of threat or something like that. So does that still hold some water or not? And also, since we're mentioning the replication crisis and social psychology, is it the case really that people resort to religion to try to reduce the psychological effects of threat salience?
Okay, so there's quite a lot in that question. The first part is a question about, in the context of the replication crisis and so forth, is this empirically a pattern? So by that I mean that cues of, do you mean death in particular or other threats?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit complicated. That's why earlier you were saying that we also have to disentangle things a little bit, right?
Yes.
Because there's death when we talk about things like terror management theory, right? But then we can also probably associate religion and religiousness with group gregariousness, and that would also apply to other kinds of threat, like, for example, when we are threatened by other groups, right?
Yes, gosh, so much. This is going to be a long answer. Okay, so in terms of is it empirically the case that people become more or that religiosity can be intensified by cues of certain kinds of threat? Yes, I say that not only as someone who's looked at literature, but also as someone who's contributed to it, and I even as someone who's sitting on some unpublished data. Yeah, I think so. And I mean, here in particular, cues or stimuli or primes of death or mortal peril. So I don't know if I should even say this, but one of the pieces of unpublished data that I've got is a study in which people were taking the perspective of someone walking in a very high building. And this was actually not the focus of the study, but it's kind of ancillary question. I threw in a religiosity measure, and sure enough, even that cue led people to report greater belief in God and so forth. Just having imagined themselves and watched this kind of harrowing video of walking at a great height. But some work done under the rubric, I would say, I don't agree with terror management theory on almost any level, but some people who are motivated by that framing have done interesting work in which they reminded people of death and then measured religiosity. And those effects seem, I've replicated some of them myself, and that's coming as someone who is openly hostile to terror management theory. So I think the empirical fact is pretty robust. But all of this, okay. You put it as they religiosity is increased in order to basically not be scared, if I were to put it into ordinary terms. That goes back to my sort of first gripe, which is it to reduce anxiety? Is that the function? Or is that proximately maybe something that happens? But in terms of ascribing some ultimate function, I'm not sure. I think there's the interesting theorizing that one could do about why this might be the case, and hopefully we'll touch on that a little bit. But before I say anything else, I've got to address what to me is always a huge elephant in the room, is when people talk about religion, it's not clear that that construct is much better than a folk construct. That's quite culturally circumscribed to kind of European, North American, and Middle Eastern kind of framing, or perhaps just particularly to like big global religions like Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, so forth, Hinduism. But I would really recommend there's a great paper by Ryan McKay and Harvey Whitehouse, where 2015, where I think where they provide an analysis of the foundations of religion, and they basically break it out into multiple different parts, which include things like belief in supernatural agents, things like if they are supernatural agents, like are they moralizing or not, or do they have are they evaluating our behavior in terms of its propriety? But they break out a number of different foundations, quite similar to the way that Jonathan Haidt and his colleagues have looked at different foundations for morality. People talk about morality as if, oh, we all know what we're talking about, but it may actually really involve different components. And with religion, I think this is manifestly the case, and we have to realize different societies throughout, on Earth now and as we go back through history, may have supernatural beliefs, but whether or not that constitutes a religion, or what we think we have in mind when we say religion, including social institutions, a number of norms, and so forth, it's not exactly clear. So I tend to try to use words like supernatural beliefs, things like that, which, and then even to narrowly define sort of which ones I mean. So in my work on this topic, I've been really interested in belief in intervening supernatural agents.
Okay.
And I think if you are in a culture where you have access to those kinds of beliefs, then yes, it might be a thing people do, which is when feeling threatened or you know, that they're going to die, or I mean, we are, by the way, that there might be comfort to be had, and people, those kinds of people might upregulate their investment and those beliefs. In fact, I've done research showing that and even giving some hint at the brain mechanisms that might be involved, which we can talk about more if you want. But I don't think it's the case that religion exists to do that at all. And in fact, there are many religious beliefs which are not reassuring, and some societies may entirely lack concepts akin to something like heaven or a positive afterlife and things like that. So we should be really careful not to, you know, project what seems intuitive to us from our cultural background onto the actual phenomena of what humans believe about invisible magical forces and people and so forth.
Just before we move on to another topic, so what you're trying to say, if I understood it correctly, is that first of all, we have to be sure about what aspect of religiousness we are talking about, because there are different ones, right?
Yes,
and then we also have to be careful not to think that all things that religious people communicate to their societies, right, or the kinds of beliefs that people hold, that they are always positive ones, right?
Yes. And, you know, if you'll indulge me, I can cite a little bit of my own research and that of my colleagues to sort of make the point. So we've done some work where we had people listen to a guided visualization. Mm-hmm. I don't recall if I mentioned this last time. Hopefully not. But no, I don't think so. So this was field research, and I'm just going to, there were interesting differences, but for time purposes, I'll just sort of describe them both at once. This was, one study was at a paintball arena and involved people playing, you know what paintball is?
Could you tell people?
Yeah, it's a very American thing.
There probably are people in my audience that don't know what it is about.
It's, I'm sure it exists around the world to some extent, but Americans, many Americans like to run around in armor on hot days, pretending they're in a war. And what they do is they have these, they're called markers, but they're basically paintball guns that shoot little projectiles of paint. And as a researcher, I love this because the paint hurts, especially if you're hit on a part of open skin. It can even leave a mark. So there's real costs. And in terms of a vivid simulation of something like urban warfare, it's about as close as you're going to get ethically. And so we did research in that context. And we also did research with a knife fighting class where novice people who weren't experienced with knife fighting, it was a martial arts class basically, used simulated knives. They were hard plastic. And again, not out of, I don't think, any kind of inner sadism, but as a researcher looking for a realistic model of conflict, I was very excited by how painful these knives could be. In fact, at the class, there were Band-Aids and things because you could get little cuts. They weren't really dangerous, but there was some real cost if you got stuck with one of these knives. It would actually hurt. So what we did in both of these studies was pretty similar. We had people gather together and ostensibly to look at, psychologists love using very cryptic, framings because you don't want to give people a clear idea of what you're looking at. So we said the influence of visualization on athleticism or something like that. And, so unbeknownst to them, one group was listening to a very vivid description of supernatural forces protecting and helping them during the upcoming battle. And the control condition was a similarly vivid and positively valenced description of hanging out next to a tree and touching it and feeling. So we were trying to control for just the act of a positive and engaging visualization. But in one hand, it had everything to do with supernatural forces helping you in conflict, and the other, nothing to do with it. And we found in both of these studies significant effects of the visualization, where people became again, I'm sort of summarizing, there was a lot of interesting nuances in the data, but essentially they were more confident about their ability to win and to perform well in the battle beforehand. And in one of the studies, they retrospectively thought they had done better as well. And they had kind of like a positive illusion about how well they had done. When in fact, we contrived such things such that you couldn't really do well, because that would be a confound.
Yeah.
Because if someone actually won and you ask them, do you think you won? They could tell you, yeah, I won. So there was no objective winning in this, at least that we're aware of. Interestingly, I really want to know whether they were better, whether in a sort of Dumbo's feather-like way, this heightened confidence or feeling of supernatural support led them to actually, you know, shoot more accurately or, you know, dance around with their knives and get more touches on their opponents. That's an open question, which I hope to get back to one of these days. But we found, yeah, that just a roughly 1 minute long visualization exercise could lead people in a very realistic context, two different contexts, knife fighting and paintball, to actually have greater confidence in, you know, a pretty real model or a good proxy for actual violent conflict. Mm-hmm. And this kind of conceptually replicates a finding that we've done, my colleagues at UCLA and I had done in an online study, where we just very subtly primed the idea of supernatural agents that were supportive. And just doing that led people to significantly imagine an ambiguous terrorist, or maybe a violent criminal, I can't remember, as being physically smaller. Mm-hmm. In other words, the feeling that they had the supernatural support gave them greater confidence and led them to appraise their enemy as less threatening. And so that is one place. So is the story then that religion, or I should say, perceived supernatural support makes you violent? Mm-hmm. No. I don't have my own data on this, but theoretically, it depends on how this plays out in terms of other aspects of the person and the situation. But I believe that things like Buddhist monks or often religiously motivated political opponents who can do things like self-immolate. Mm-hmm. For example, the person who set themselves on fire outside the office of Robert McNamara to protest the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. In other situations like this, can actually be overtly pacifistic and wielded in a way that is the opposite of someone who's a hawk or, you know, wants to pursue violent conflict. So it really depends, but whether the downstream effect is greater inclinations to attack with the group or confidence in the ability to attack or greater perceptions of being able to endure the physical harm and death from something as horrific as self-immolation or even less dramatic examples, people who go and, you know, tie themselves to nuclear warheads or do other kinds of peace activism related activities that are supported by their belief that they are supernaturally, you know, in God's hands or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think it can play out in all different ways depending on the person. The key thing for my purposes is it does appear to be the case that perceived supernatural support, benevolent agents, does lead people to be able to look with greater sanguinity on risk and be able to approach physically threatening things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's shift gears a little bit here and talk about a completely different topic that is a more recent one in your work. Let's talk a little bit about human-robot interaction. And it's unfortunate that now we're going through this coronavirus crisis because otherwise you would be able to show us Andy, the android, right? That is one of the robots.
Right. No, were it not the case, we'd be at my lab at UC Merced. And I would be, it might be better for me because I know that the actors don't like to try to perform against children or, you know, animals or things because they're just so much more interesting to look at. And the robot would be pretty compelling. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it is what it is. Yeah. So you just have to take my word for it.
Yeah. Maybe somewhere in the future we can do a third talk, and then people will have the chance to see Andy, right?
So that might be a good idea as well, because a lot of what I'm going to say very briefly about human robot interaction work that my lab is doing is very much kind of table setting cheap talk, in that we've only begun to do a lot of it. And so I can really just say a little bit about why we're doing it and the theoretical framing. So I've done a bunch of work looking at things like appraisals of the degree of threat posed by an enemy or an enemy group, mm-hmm. and factors that lead individuals to either coordinate around a leader and engage in conflict against the group or not. So all of this, of course, with humans as the intended appraisers and appraisees, the people who are being evaluated. And as we are at the dawn of genuine human-machine teaming, and we already have it in terms of people using the phone in their pocket to find out their navigational instructions or other
kinds. And also some self-driving cars that are already out there, right?
Absolutely. And, mm-hmm. Roomba has been with us for 20 years or something. I think we are, in the next 10 to 20 years, going to see quite a big increase in not only robots, but certainly artificial agents embedded in our technology and kind of ubiquitous in human social life in developed countries. My particular interest, though, is in military applications and police applications involving both use of force decisions and other decisions of a life and death nature. So, for example, in a search and rescue or emergency evacuation context, mm-hmm. What are factors that lead to positive outcomes in the sense that this is kind of translational work for me. It's theoretically interesting, but we really just want to mitigate loss of life, hopefully by giving decision makers and people designing these interactions and agents mm-hmm. basic science that they can use to minimize over-reliance or under-reliance trust. So just to give a quick example of what the little bit that has been done, my colleague Alan Wagner, who's now at Penn State, mm-hmm. he did a study you might have even heard of. It was a pretty amazing and a pretty well covered study a few years ago, in which they simulated a fire in a building with no windows and so forth. And they did this extremely realistically with blaring alarms and smoke and everything. And both, if you see the videos of the participants and interviews afterwards, indicated that the participants believed it. Mm-hmm. So for all intents and purposes, they're in a genuine life-threatening emergency. Mm-hmm. And in this building, there was an emergency guide robot, or so it claimed to be, which was really a very non-anthropomorphic, sort of looked like a garbage can upside down on wheels with two big arm sort of appendages attached to it. And this thing would roam around. Mm-hmm. And during the emergency, people followed this robot at an astonishing rate, almost 100% of the sample, mm-hmm. followed the robot past clearly marked exits and into essentially death rooms, or, in one case, they had people, the robot leading people into a room that was dark, had furniture sort of in the way, and you had to sort of push past the furniture to even get into the room, and there's clearly marked exits that they're avoiding. Mm-hmm. And so that's just one kind of alarming example of the potential for over-reliance, but it gets worse mm-hmm. because they manipulated beforehand, before the emergency, the competence of the robot or whether it glitched. Yeah. And there was a condition in which the robot obviously malfunctioned very badly. It was leading people around and around in circles that made no sense. Mm-hmm. People are just sort of following it, but it was unambiguously the case that the robot was not to be trusted. Mm-hmm. It's made no difference. And they found somewhat similar patterns in a sort of online study, which used a 3D model of an evacuation setting, not as compellingly realistic. But here is some preliminary evidence that when you're in a threatening emergency situation, there's a sort of lemming-like tendency to conform with these robotic agents. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping we're beginning to collaborate on work on this area together, where we're looking not only at different threat contexts, but also different kinds of robots. And we're essentially manipulating the degree of anthropomorphism to see to what extent. So as an evolutionary psychologist, it's kind of interesting to sit there and think, what's happening inside of a human mind when they meet my robot, Andy, the android? Mm-hmm. One imagines them sort of toggling between categories in terms of what they think this object is. Yeah. Is this a thing? Is this a social agent? Is it like an animal? Is it a kind of weird outgroup member?
Yeah.
What is it? And so what I hope to do as we move forward is clarify both what psychological systems are invoked when people engage with different kinds of robots, but also what are the decision-making blind spots. So in the lab, we're using a virtual reality. It's much easier than going out to paintball if you can sort of put it in your lab, and also much easier to control. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is we're having people engage in decision-making tasks with the robot, both in the lab space, and we're developing a virtual environment in which the robot is present as well. And we're going to use this kind of basic approach to look at human-robot interaction under extreme threat about life or death decisions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Dr. Holbrook, what do you say if we schedule a further conversation later in the year to try to have access to your lab and for you to show us Andy the android, and then probably we could have another hour or 1 hour and something to explore the topic of human-robot interaction with more time and more deeply, and also other topics of your work that we haven't touched on today?
I think that sounds great. I love the optimism that you think that by later this year, the lab will be open and so forth. I haven't looked at the news about Portugal. Maybe it's in a better state than the United States is.
It is.
Oh, that's, I'm really glad to hear it in a way. It's sad to hear it. I wish we were all doing so well. I wish we could all be New Zealand.
Or Australia even.
Yeah. But, well, fires notwithstanding. But, when I have some actual data, enough with the cheap talk, but when we've got a few studies under our belt and hopefully under review and I can talk about them openly, that would be great to have you meet Andy.
Yeah. Okay. So before we go, would you like again to mention, I will be leaving the link to our first interview in the description box of this interview, but would you like to mention again what are some of the best places on the internet for people to find your work?
Thank you. The best place, I guess, is my website, which is just my name.com, colinholbrook.com. Yeah. If you visit that website, you'll be treated to a lush display of all the best things that Notepad can do. Yeah. I've been meaning to get around to having a fancier website for literally 7 or 8 years now. But what you're seeing there is me literally coding HTML in a text document. But so far, that's been sufficient. I don't have any kind of a Twitter presence or I'm actually one of these people that's quite leery of social media. Yeah. And I don't think it's good for us.
There are some positive aspects to it there.
No doubt. And I think
do you have any account on ResearchGate?
I think I do. It's sort of, I should probably give that some attention as well. Academia.edu I find to be sort of overly pushy, so I don't.
I don't like it.
I don't like it either. But I do have a ResearchGate page. Well, here's what I'll say about my my simple website, which is, you know, you might find whatever PDFs you want there. Maybe I'm not particularly animated around the restrictions and firewalls that for-profit prestige journals and publishing houses want to maintain. It's all bad. And also a quick word, as a member of the UC, I encourage any academics or grad students listening to me to boycott Elsevier. And that includes not only not submitting your manuscripts there, but don't review for them, don't edit for them. If they ask you, tell them that Elsevier needs to stop its predatory practices. And we need to take this seriously. And then after Elsevier, we can turn our fire on the next worst of these for-profit journals, because I don't think they really have a place. Mm-hmm. But that's a different conversation.
Let's end on that note, and probably next time we can explore that a little bit more.
Warfare. Against the journals, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so Dr. Holbrook, I will include that in the description box of the interview so that people can go and read your work if they're interested in it. And thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. And as I said, hopefully we will do a third talk later this year. Let's see how things go, right?
Well, thank you again very much for the invitation. It's a real honor to me, especially given the unbelievable people that you've interviewed. I don't really fit on this list, but I'm not going to stop you. But it's really something. It's a wonderful show.
Come on. There are people that are, I mean, I have all sorts of people on the show. The only thing that matters to me is that their work is interesting and well researched and things like that. So,
well, it's a club that I'm very, very happy to be in, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. I've been doing quite a lot of interviews with top academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields since February 2018, but the channel is still not sustainable, so if you can, please head to my Patreon page and consider making a pledge there, any amount you feel comfortable with. And if you prefer places like PayPal, you can also go there. All of the links are in the description box of the interview. So if you can, please help me. Really, I would really love to keep doing this project in the long run. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per-Erga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Marco Neves, Max Bailby, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Newman, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omari Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevan Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Staten T, my producers, Isar Webb, Rosie, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Codriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Vanagdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, and Vega Giddy, and my executive producer, Michel Rugieski. Thank you for all.